Israeli.
Start.
All right, I'll start. Kumi ori ki va orech uchvod Adonai alayach sabach. Kumi ori ki va orech uchvod Adonai alayach sabach. Kumi ori ki va orech uchvod Adonai alayach sabach. Kumi ori ki va orech uchvod Adonai alayach sabach. English. Arise, shine, your light has come, the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Arise, shine, your light has come, the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Arise, shine, your light has come, the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Arise, shine, your light has come, the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Hine hachoshech yechese eret ve'arafel le'umim ve'alayich yizrach Adonai uchvodo alayich yira'eh. Go back to the beginning. Kumi ori ki va'orech uchvod Adonai alayich sabach. Kumi ori ki va'orech uchvod Adonai alayich sabach. Amen. All right. That was just to punctuate the fact this is a really celebratory, gross darkness all over the world, and the glory of God appearing. And God is wonderful to appear in darkness. And he goes on to say, in this time of darkness, we skip forward in the Isaiah 60 reading to jump to a different theme, but it says, instead of being forsaken and hated, which Jewish people have experienced, and no man passing through, I will make you as an agaon, as an excellency, as important, as brilliant, excellency and eternal excellency, a joy of generation to generation was the promise the prophet made. And you shall nurse on the chelev, the breast, the milk of kings, and the breasts of kings you shall enjoy, you shall bless, and you shall know that ani, I am Adonai, your Savior and your Redeemer. And in place, and it goes on poetically, in place of brass, I'll bring you gold. And in place of iron, I'll bring silver. And in place of wood, you'll have brass. And in place of stones, you'll have iron. I will make you samti. I will make you as your officers, shalom, and your executors, it says, exactors, tzedakah, all your officials and servants. And so this verse was added on to the reading. The real reading is about the beginning part, the darkness and the light of God. But this very much punctuates the idea of what Promise Keepers is about. It's actually one message is the name of the website. If you want to know more of what I'm going to, if you remember, how many of you guys, of course, have ever been to a Promise Keepers function? Okay, quite a few hands. It's very impacting. The largest men's ministry filled up Arrowhead Stadium. I don't think our congregation would fill up Arrowhead Stadium, you think? But we were there, and it was amazing. And you've probably heard me tell the story that when we were there, one of the themes they did one year was they had unity, and they had an Afro-American pastor and a Hispanic pastor and an Asian pastor and just every ethnicity you could think of. But there were no representatives of Israel, the Jewish people. And it's a little bit of a long story, but they were challenged, and they took the challenge to heart and gave up the biggest ministry in the world to decide to help and support the revival, the Romans 11 revival, that says that if the casting away of the Jewish people at the beginning of the age of faith, the age of believers, and, you know, 33, 34 CE, if that was riches to the world, then what would the renewing of them be but life from the dead? And I firmly believe this messianic revival we're in is not just about Israel. It is about Israel, but as Israel revives, it's about life from the dead to the world. And amen. And they gave up this worldwide hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people to do the promised kingdom. Now they're bringing it to Jerusalem this very next week. They'll be there for the opening of the MJA Joseph Storehouse. And just from their website, it says the revival, the Messianic revival, began 65 years ago, in a sense, when the state of Israel was reborn in a day. Since then, Jewish people have been turning by the thousands to recognize Yeshua as their long-awaited Messiah, Romans 11. And as foretold, these Jewish believers are growing in number. Yeshua himself prayed these Jewish believers unified with the vast numbers of Gentile believers would result in a world recognizing that he was truly sent by God. And if you can, I guess you can read this, the greatest revival the world has ever known. And they quote many of the major evangelists of the history of the faith. One message is called to inspire and motivate the body of Messiah to come together in unity, fulfillment of Yeshua's prayer in John 17. And when this happens, we believe the greatest revival the world has ever experienced will take place. So I would request your prayer support, not just for me and my travels. This isn't just a vacation fun trip. I'm sure it will be fun, but you're a blessing. But I'm building relations with many, many non-Jewish pastors and leaders and people, and they're going to see what God is doing in the land and what God is doing to rebuild Yisrael and rebuild the faith, and that this would be a time of us connecting with church leaders and us connecting with people in the land, that God would just further the Romans 11 prophetic growth and restoration and renewal. And we just love and bless Promise Keepers. It will be at least one of the services. We'll send you a spam out if you're on our email list. At least one of the services will be streamed to the public over the internet. But now to expound on the early part of this verse, it says darkness will cover the land and gross darkness will cover the people. Arafel, this gross darkness will cover the land. We are in a time today of real gross darkness in many areas. Gross darkness just means untruth. In Isaiah, it says, in the last days, they'll call good evil and evil good. And I want to get into something that's very politically incorrect. You may be with me, you may not be with me, but here it goes. Let's make two things clear. Our president said a couple of days ago, ISIL is not Islamic. No religion condones the killing of innocent. The vast majority of ISIL's victims have been Muslims. ISIL is a terrorist organization, pure and simple, has no vision for other than the slaughter of all who stand in its way. That, my dear people, is not so. You can take me to task for it later. Now, mind you, there are moderate, they're called Sufi, I believe is the name, Khalil Gibran, if you know that poetry, the prophet. There are those types of mystical Muslims, but that is not mainstream Quran. We are in warfare, and ISIL, I mean, who is he to say they're not Muslim? They say themselves they're Islamic, so that's what it is. And indeed, in the Quran, there are many dreadful verses about the actual beheadings and things that are going on. Now, I'm not saying that so we would hate anyone. You've heard me probably say I serve on the board of Taysir Abu Sada's organization, in which it's a ministry to Muslims, and he's been a precious brother, and he will be here over time. We have him come back from time to time. But the point that I'm making is that we are in warfare. People are out to destroy us and to kill us. Let me read you something from one, I think, of the best commentators understands Islam, understands the Middle East, Daniel Pipes. Do any of you get his newsletter? If you get his newsletter, it's wonderfully informative. It's not that long. It's every couple of days. He doesn't stuff your email box, but he's very insightful. And he says, in nearly all cases, the jihadi terrorists have a patently self-evident ambition to establish a world dominated by Muslims, Islam, and Islamic laws, Sharia, or, again, to cite the Daily Telegraph, their real project is the extension of Islamic territory across the globe and the establishment of worldwide caliphate founded on Sharia law. Terrorists openly declare this goal. The Islamists who assassinated Anwar al-Sadat in 1981, he's the one who made the treaty with Israel, very brave man, decorated their holding cages with banners proclaiming the caliphate or death. Biography of one of the most influential Islamist thinkers of recent times and an influence on Osama bin Laden declares that his life revolved around a single goal, namely the establishment of Allah's rule on earth, restoring the caliphate. And just to make sure we're not using any ambiguous terms, a caliphate means a political religious state comprising the Muslim community and the lands and peoples under the dominion in the centuries following the death of the Prophet Muhammad, ruled by a caliph, and it's from an Arabic word, who held temporal and sometimes a degree of spiritual authority in the empire. The empire of the caliphate grew rapidly through conquest during its lifetime of two centuries to include most of Southwest Asia, North Africa, and Spain. And then they have dynastic struggles, and some say there's been three caliphates, and Osama bin Laden was looking to reestablish the fourth. Anyhow, it's different ways of counting it. Glenn is not here today, but Glenn Balmer is an expert on all this history. But here's a map of the caliphate, the Abbasid caliphate, at the end of the 9th century, the end of the 800s, so shortly after Muhammad himself lived. And as you can see, it conquered nearly all the known, at least the Mediterranean world didn't conquer the Far East, but it was stopped from going into Spain at the Battle of Tours, actually in France. And then later, the Ottoman Empire was another caliphate that was stopped from conquering Europe at the Battle of Vienna. And Vienna is deep into Europe in Austria. And so they definitely have an ambition, a world-conquering ambition. It's not correct to say that they're not Islamic. Now, ISIL, it's in the news today, this is their planning strategy map of 2006, that they would take this much territory, some of what's in Syria and some of what's in Iraq, and they've pretty well done what they planned to do. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning all this is to build your faith when you see how this comes together. There's a lot of maps and a lot of history, but Scripture is full of geographic names and history. So the U.S. is now committed to confront the ISIL caliphate. By the way, in case you ever wondered why all these variant names, originally the name that hit the papers was called ISIS, the Islamic State of Syria, or in Syria, Islamic State in Syria. But that was misleading, because Syria, as we understand it, was defined at the close of World War I by a diplomatic agreement called the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and confirmed by the League of Nations, and they consider Syria to really be a bogus country. When they said Syria originally, they meant what's sometimes referred to as Greater Syria. Greater Syria was the Ottoman province, I believe, of Syria, which was a huge landmass, but they realized saying the Islamic State of Syria was deceiving, so they changed it to Islamic State of the Levant. The L there means the Levant, which is sort of an antiquated word, we don't use it much, but it means the East, the whole East, the whole Middle East is what they are anticipating. But since that was a little bit of an ambiguous term, they just went to the Islamic State, and their ambitions are to have a world utterly, ultimately, caliphate. Now, I personally never discuss from the pulpit and do not believe in most of the conspiracy theories that are rife among a lot of people. And that may put me on your bad side, but that's where I am. People talk about the Illuminati conspiracy, the CFR conspiracy, the Rothschild conspiracy. It usually goes back to the Rothschild. Most of the conspiracies have an underlying Jewish threat. The Jews are taking over the world in some way or other. Besides comedy and Hollywood, I don't think Jews have been able to do that too well. We have most of the comedians, but other than that. But there's British conspiracies that Prince Charles is, you know, you read all these things, they're amazing. There's Roman Catholic conspiracies, of course, there's a communist conspiracy, that sort of fell by the wayside since communism has fallen down, but Putin's kind of reviving. But anyhow, that's a whole other issue. There's many conspiracy theories that are out there. I don't think any group is smart enough. The worst one is the Illuminati CFR conspiracy that a bunch of Jews got together, or leaders got together and planned World War I and then World War II, and they knew how the whole thing would work. I don't think any of that's true. But I do think that Hasatan, Satan, has the conniving power to plan and conspire in dreadful ways. And that's what I want to bring our attention to a little bit, a satanic conspiracy that's before us. Because if the U.S. forms an alliance that confronts the ISIS or ISIL or whatever they are, caliphate, we will apparently ignore the greater danger of a nuclear Iran and the Shiite caliphate. So don't think that things are under control. They're not nearly under control. But I want to show you how God is able to orchestrate history in spite of what we are doing. When I say we, I mean the leaders of the world are doing. We will strengthen the Kurds, which in a sense are the successors to Assyria. And I'll explain all this in a minute. And in so doing, God will control history, fulfilling prophecy, fulfilling Isaiah 19. Now, this gets a little complicated, so bear with me. The Shiites, which are the Iranians, I guess there's two I's in there. Anyhow, the Shiites have a different form of Islam. They believe in the return of the 12th Mahdi, and so they don't have the same caliphate concept as the Sunnis do, as ISIL do, and so these guys are actually dreadful enemies. The worst thing we could do is ally ourselves with the Shiites, thinking that the ISIS is worse, because they're all worse. They're all committed to world empire in a bloody and in a very destructive way. So what I want to point out to you is what I think God is doing to fulfill Isaiah 19 in spite of what you see in front of you. Now, one of the things that we're going to be doing as a nation is strengthening the Kurds, who are the successors to Assyria. And this is all prophetic, so bear with me. Here's where the Kurdish, here's the part of Iraq, modern Iraq, that the Kurds have control of. And they recently, I believe, took back control of Kirkuk, which is one of the cities in their region. Here is a map, this is from Daniel Pipes, of what the entire Kurdish region could be. This is where the Kurdish population is. Some of it's in Turkey, some of it's in Iran, some of it's in Iraq, a little bit of it's in Syria. It's a very interesting display of nations. Now, what's amazing about the Kurds is they are basically in the same territory that in the scriptures the Assyrian Empire had. So when you read, which we're going to read in a little bit in Isaiah 19, about Asshur or Assyria, you can actually read. Here's the core of the Assyrian Empire in Nineveh, and Nineveh is modern Mosul. You could read that as being Kurdistan. It's the same basic area. They're sort of the successor geographically to the Kurds are the successors to the Assyrians. So when you see Assyria, you can read Kurds, the Kurdish people. Now, what's amazing about that is that the Kurdish army is called the Peshmerga, and it's established itself as a competent and disciplined force. And there was a quote in the Jewish Chronicle that I've been saving for about 2 months to read, and I left it on my desk today, so I'm going to try to remember what it says. But there was a journalist, a Kurdish journalists, they got to be friends with an Israeli, and they were having a conversation, and the Kurds were saying how we identify with Israel big time. We are friends of Israel. Israel has our support. Israel, because we are very much in sync with them, in sync with them. It's basically a secular state. It's Islamic, but it's secular Islamic. And their army, the Peshmerga, has established itself as a competent and disciplined force. Not super, it needs training and help and weaponry, but the KRG, the Kurdish army, rejected the terrorist methods then notoriously used by Kurds in Turkey. They were a terrorist group, but they've stopped. The economy has boomed. The Kurds' two leading political families, the Talibanis and the Barzanis, they've learned to coexist. The KRG have engaged in responsible diplomacy. Leadership has signed international trade accords. 10 institutions of higher learning have come into existence. Kurdish culture has blossomed. An Israeli scholar named Ofra Bagnio describes it, autonomous Kurdistan has proved to be the most stable, prosperous, peaceful, and democratic part of Iraq. You could say, some have called it the Switzerland of the Middle East or of the region. Here's a picture of their capital, Erbil, which has an ancient fortress city in the middle of it, obviously, and it's flourishing. It's doing very well. The Kurds are friends to Israel, already friends of Israel. As a matter of fact, many years ago when the Joseph Project just started and the first shipping container went over, a guy named David Dreiling, who organized, made the connection with Don Tipton of Friendships, that there's been the shipping methodology to take containers and multiplied containers to Israel, was going to take a shipment to the Kurds. Didn't work out back then. That was in like 2008 or so. But the Kurds have always been friendly to Israel. It's very interesting that right now we are in a position to arm and ally ourselves with the Kurds. And again, here's a picture just for your understanding. This is Kurdistan. This is northern Iran, and reaching an arc here, touching the Mediterranean at that possible point. Now, having said that, in order to understand Isaiah 19, we've got to move to the south. This is Israel, of course, is right here, and this is to the north and northeast. So we need to move to the south to understand the other side of the prophecy, Yeshayahu or Isaiah 19. This is a prophecy about Egypt. Look, Adonai is riding a swift cloud. On his way to Egypt, the water will ebb from the sea. The river will be drained dry. The rivers will become foul. The canals of Egypt's Nile will dwindle and dry up. The reeds and rushes will wither. The river plants on the banks of the Nile and everything sown near the Nile will dry up, blow away, and be no more. Before I read the next slide, just to get the context of it, from ancient times, the Nile has been the source of life for Egypt. An ancient historian wrote that Egypt, the nation of Egypt, the prosperity of Egypt, is the gift of the Nile. Because, I'm sure most of you are familiar with this history, but the Nile rises, we'll show maps in a minute, the Nile rises in the mountains of southeastern Africa, Lake Tanganyika, or around there, Lake Victoria, and picks up huge amounts of silt from the jungle, and every year in the spring floods, it overflows its banks, and that's actually why the Egyptians were the first ones to invent geometry, because once the banks were overflowed, they had to figure out whose land was where, and they came up with all kinds of interesting devices. But nevertheless, every year it overflowed its banks and dropped all this rich silt on the land, and the land became very fertile, so that Egypt was considered the breadbasket of ancient times. Now, the prophet is saying that the river is going to dry up. The water will ebb from the sea. That is, the Nile forms a delta where it enters into the Mediterranean. It's saying that's all going to dry out, become foul. How can anybody make a prediction like that, that the Nile River would become foul? The Nile River would not flow. Canals of Egypt's Nile will dry up. Reeds and rushes. It's a very dismal and amazing and incomprehensible prophecy. And it goes on to say, fishermen too will lament. All who cast hooks in the Nile will mourn. Those who spread nets on the water will lose heart. The line workers will be in despair. And along the weavers of white cotton, Egypt was famous for its linen. Matter of fact, there's a word for linen. I believe it's the word boots, the special Egyptian linen that was used in the temple cloth and temple decoration. The spinners will be crushed. Hired workers dejected. Now, what is this prophesying? I'll tell you what it's prophesying. Here is a picture of Africa and the Mediterranean Sea. You can't see the colors that well. Maybe we should bring down these spots a little bit so I can show you this particular slide. It's not that bright colored. But here's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the Nile Delta. Here's the Nile. The Nile forks right here. So here's the White Nile that continues to Lake Victoria, its origin. And the Blue Nile is the other fork that goes into Ethiopia. Now, in about 1950, the Americans decided to bless Egypt with a survey in which we would build them a dam. So we built, you see this is Lake Nasser, but it's just a tiny little thing there. We built them what's called the Aswan High Dam. It's high because there's a big drop between the lake here, Lake Nasser, and the bottom. Now, some of you know the history, know that actually, at a certain point in the construction of this dam, the Egyptians were mistreating, and there got to be a big balagan, a big argument between the American Engineering Company and the Egyptians, and the Americans abandoned the project. The Russians took it over and finished the dam, but they did a lot of things that were not so well done. Anyhow, the point of this is, here's a satellite picture of the dam. You see the curve of it, because the water flows to the north, so it's stopped by this curved dam, and then it continues on downstream. But what has happened, the result of it is, it started the fulfillment of prophecy. At the Messiah Conference, this is why I urge people to go to regional conferences. You hear some expert people that we just can't get. Joseph Farah, who's famous from the World Net Daily, WND website, at the conference, he says the Nile will dry up. It's the longest river in the world, but he says since the Aswan High Dam was built in 1970, 70 million tons of this fertilizing silt I was telling you about are not flowing. They're connecting in Lake Nasser and basically ruining the Egyptian economy, the Egyptian agriculture. But it's not totally ruined because there's still a lot of water coming in and they have ways of letting it out. But between the Russians and the Americans and the way the design was changed because there was a change of engineering corps, it's not going right. It's killing Egypt. But what's really interesting is in 2017, the Ethiopians will be completing a dam that they call the Great Renaissance on the Blue Nile, and 60% of the Nile water will be lost to Egypt because it'll be in the dam, be used for hydroelectric power. They have to fill the lake. There's evaporation that'll happen in the lake, up to 60%. It's controversial exactly how it's going to work. Now, Ezekiel the prophet speaks into this. He says, human being, turn your face against Pharaoh, king of Egypt, prophesy against him and against all Egypt. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, you big crocodile lying in the streams of the Nile, you say my river is mine. Pharaoh considers himself to be the ruler of the Nile. And Pharaoh says, I made it for myself, but I'll put hooks in your jaws and make your Nile fish stick to your scales. Yeah, I'll bring you up from your Nile with all your Nile fish sticking to your clothes and leaving the desert, and you and all your Nile fish, the land of Egypt will become a desolate waste. And they will know that I am Adonai because Pharaoh said, the Nile is mine. I made it. How do you make a river? But anyhow, that was the mentality. I am against you and your Nile. I will make the land of Egypt a totally desolate waste from Migdal, which means the tower, to Sfaneh, all the way to the border of Ethiopia. Now get this. This is what's electrifying about this. Sfaneh in Hebrew, here's the Migdal Sfaneh ad Gvul, to the border of Cush. So here's the modern spelling of Aswan, the Aswan High Dam. That's the city that the dam is named after. Now, if you know the Hebrew letters, the Alephs drop out in this case, and you have the Samech and the Vav and the Nun. And Aswan, the scripture I just quoted, I was make the land of Egypt a desolate waste, from Migdal to Sfaneh, all the way to the borders of Egypt. Sfaneh is actually a not very veiled statement of Aswan. The desolation of Egypt was prophesied by Ezekiel to be at Sfaneh, at the Aswan Dam. Sfaneh equals Aswan. The prophet Ezekiel, about 500 years before, yeah, he was a prophet of the exile, so maybe 700 years before Yeshua, made this prophecy in slightly veiled terms that Aswan would be the destruction of Egypt. And then further, here's the picture of the Blue Nile. The Aswan Dam is right about here. But at the border of Ethiopia, the Ethiopians are then building, here's the Aswan Dam. The Ethiopians are building this great Renaissance dam. And here's a topographical map picture. But in any case, here's what it will look like. It's not built yet. It's about 30% built. It'll be completed in 2017. It'll take another 60%, up to another 60% of the flow of the Nile. And between the Aswan Dam, let me read to you what the write-up is. The potential impact of this dam have been the source of severe regional controversy. The government of Egypt, which relies on the waters of the Nile, has demanded Ethiopia cease construction and has even sought support to attack it and to sabotage it. Matter of fact, one of their conferences about what to do about the new dam that the Ethiopians were building happened to be, the conference was televised, and then when they thought the cameras were off, they continued to talk about strategies to destroy the dam under construction. Unfortunately, when you're still on camera and everything you do goes public, it's not so good for diplomacy. And so everybody found there's a big balagan about that, and they apologized. Oh, we were just kind of thinking, you know, okay, whatever. But since the Aswan High Dam was built in 1970, as I mentioned, 40 million tons of fertilizing silt is not flowing, and this will be much worse when this dam is built on the borders of Ethiopia. So the prophet goes on to say along this line, with all your Nile fish sticking to your scales and leave you in the desert, talking about Pharaoh, you and all your Nile fish, the land of Egypt will become a desolate waste. They will know that I am Adonai, because he said, the Nile is mine. I will make it. So I am against you and your Nile. I will make the land of Egypt a totally desolate waste, from Migdal to Sfaneh, all the way to the border of Ethiopia. Now, here's the turnaround. Here's my conclusion. I'm about done. Isaiah 19. Adonai, in this time of distress, Egypt's the most populous Arab country of all. Right now, with al-Sisi, they're actually in some degree of friendship to Israel, or at least in a supportive role to Israel. Maybe offered the Palestinians the Sinai Desert, if you heard that. But in any case, it says, Adonai will make himself known to Egypt on that day. The Egyptians will know. They will worship him with sacrifices and offerings. They will make vow to him and keep them. He will listen to their prayers, and he will heal them. On that day, there will be an altar to Adonai in the middle of the land of Egypt, as well as a standing stone for Egypt at its border. It will be a sign to and a witness to Adonai Tzva'ot of Egypt. Now, here's the crucial thing that's so exciting, to me anyway. On that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Asher. Now, Asher, what nation fills the place of Asher today? Kurds, Kurdistan, if Kurdistan develops. Asher will come to Egypt, and Egypt to Asher. Egypt will worship with Asher. On that day, Israel will be a third partner with Egypt and Asher, a blessing here on earth. For Adonai Tzva'ot has blessed them. Blessed be Egypt, my people, Asher, the work of my hands, and Israel, my heritage. Here's a picture again of Kurdistan, but here's a picture of the whole Middle East. So here is Ethiopia. Here's where that second dam is going to be built. Here's Egypt. Here's where the Kurdish nation may be. And here's Israel between them. So a connection between Egypt and Israel and Kurdistan or Assyria is totally conceivable, imaginable, not by current circumstances, but by faith. So you say, well, what's the application? There's a lot of history, but tell me how to live. Tell me how to apply this to my life. What I want you to know is, it might seem like wars. And could the worship team come up? We're going to have a closing song and time of ministry. It might seem like wars are inchoate and endless and unreasonable. It might seem like we're in facing so many enemies. And if you're looking from an Israeli point of view, ISIS arising in Syria and in Iraq, and Hezbollah arising as an ally of Iran, and the Iranians are being ignored in this current conflict, and Egypt having great power, but the Egyptians actually had a change of government, so they're actually relatively friendly at this point. But I want you to know, God is working in history to accomplish his prophetic circumstances. And in your life and mine, you might see things, they're not as global, they're not as cataclysmic, they're not newsworthy, they're just little things that go wrong and don't work right and don't happen right. I want you to know our life, our great task is to worship and intercede and trust, because God will be faithful to work history. He's working this amazing little turn in history with the United States apparently allying with the Kurds as a precedent maybe to fulfilling Isaiah 19 and the devastations coming on Egypt that may push them in that direction as God reveals himself. I want you to know that you may look on the news and say this looks disastrous, but God knows the rest of the story. He knows the underlying story. So let's worship him right now, and with the prayer ministers come, and if you have something you want to just yield to Adonai at a time of distress, please feel free to do so.